Welcome to Groundwire Community Radio News, brought to you by volunteers at Canada's community radio stations. This episode of Groundwire was produced on Haudenosaunee and Anishinaabe traditional territory at CFRC in Kingston. I'll be your host, Nathan Bateman. In this episode, a young black student is pulled out of a Toronto classroom for wearing her hair natural.
A middle school student, as you said, was called into the office and told that her hair was too poofy and unprofessional and that she wouldn't get a job.
Today we'll also be covering allegations of abuse, mistreatment, neglect, and racism at the Manitoba Hydro Northern Generating Station.
Don't like their work ethics up there on how they hire Aboriginals and Métis people, and then if they start speaking out about what's going on there with the problems and all this, then they get let go. Like as for me, I got let go because I kept bringing up problems up there. When I had my chest problems, I had to drive all the way from where I was situated all the way to where the safety guy was. I nearly went off the road a couple of times there when I was driving back by myself there, and I think I stayed in a medics thing there for about close to two hours before they finally decided to take me to town.
CKUT Prison Radio read a recent press release written by GVI Prison Watch about the criminalization of LGBTQ and two-spirited prisoners in the Grand Valley Institute Federal Women's Prison located in Kitchener, Ontario.
At Grand Valley Institute for Women, GVI for short, a federal prison in Kitchener, Ontario, there's been recent crackdown against LGBTQ2+ prisoners and or prisoners in relationships amongst themselves. Harassment of prisoners includes throwing them in solitary as punishment for being in a relationship, threatening them with transfers to remote parts of the country, separating partners by placing them in different parts of the prison, and laying spurious institutional charges that can lead to being locked in the maximum security unit. Most troublingly, guards have been using physical intimidation and invasions of personal space to harass prisoners who speak up against these practices. In violation of their own rules, individual guards have been entering prisoners' cells at night with an institutional history of sexual violence and exploitation of prisoners by guards at GVI. This can only be understood as a threat. All of this is happening due to a growing culture of impunity among the guards, created by a power vacuum at higher levels. GVI currently has no warden overseeing the actions of the guards and doesn't expect to hire one for another year. The federal corrections investigator, who handles oversight and prisoner grievances, didn't have his contract renewed by the federal government, leaving no one to respond to grievance reports filed by prisoners. Compounding all this, the recent elections have left the government without a sitting Minister of Public Safety. GVI has still not made any of the necessary changes with respect to the Ashley Smith inquiry, which drew national attention as the prison was investigated by a coroner's inquest into a prisoner's death in segregation.
Nikki Kish, a musician, activist, and author, currently imprisoned in GVI, spoke out about her personal experiences of the criminalization of LGBTQ and two-spirit people inside the prison.
We had no idea that being in a public relationship in this prison would open the door for us to experience so much harm. We became subject to harsh comments and bizarre treatment from guards. Outside of the security and quiet of our cells, where we used to spend all our time, there was a corrupt and aggressive climate within this prison. It is a climate that we dove deep within to continue seeing one another. At first, they were small events. One day, guards yelled at us for passing apples. Another day, they charged my partner for carrying water for me. Over the next 6 months, things progressively got worse, exposing us to the side of this prison that we did not know existed, until today, where my partner was reclassified as a maximum security prisoner after having spent 20 days in segregation, while the acting warden decided whether or not to approve the reclassification.
Outside support right now can make a major difference in putting a check on the repression of prisoner relationships. Call Grand Valley Institute for Women at 519-894-2011. Ask for the acting warden.
CKUT's Sheila Ferrando spoke with Layla Darwish from the Skeena Conservatory. The Skeena Watershed Conservation Coalition recently signed on to a letter written by Lac Wallam's First Nation Hereditary Chief in opposition to the Pacific Northwest Liquefied Natural Gas Project. Layla Darwash summarized what the letter said.
An LNG terminal on Leelu Island cannot go through because of the impacts it's going to have to the Skeena salmon, and also because the community of Lac Wallam's said no, 100% no. So I think something that a lot of folks don't know is that the company that's pushing the LNG terminal, which is called Petronas, actually offered the community over a billion dollars, basically if they would support the project. And so the community voted and did 3 votes, and it was pretty much 100% unanimous against the project.
The letter was addressed to Prime Minister Trudeau and sent out on Monday, November 9th. At the time of this interview, no response has been received from the federal government, but they have received widespread community support.
You know, when we sent out the press release on Monday, we had about 70 to 80 people and groups and First Nations leaders signed on to this letter, and it's actually in the last few days grown to over 100. And so people keep signing on to the letter, new leaders keep kind of coming on board, and then also recently the Haida First Nation released their own resolution saying that they oppose LNG, and they're kind of to the west of kind of the Tsimshian and the Lac Wallam's. So I think what we're seeing is, again, this is a moment in BC. We haven't had a lot of unified resistance against LNG and liquefied natural gas, or against fracking for that matter, because everyone's been focused more on tar sands pipelines.
Layla also explained why the Lac Wallam's First Nation is in opposition to the Pacific Northwest Liquefied Gas Project.
The company kind of got approval from the Prince Rupert Port Authority, which is a federal body, to go ahead and do test drilling. So basically they're doing sampling, they're pulling up eelgrass and all these different really ecologically sensitive things from that area. And that's a bad thing, because what a lot of folks don't know and why we're seeing the amount of opposition we are to the Petronas LNG project is because that area right around Leelu Island and Flora Banks is probably one of the most important areas for salmon on the coast. And the Skeena Salmon Run, which is the second largest salmon run in Canada, and it supports 10 First Nations and a huge kind of population of folks in the north in terms of culture, in terms of sustenance and commercial fishing, there's basically been studies showing that if you build an LNG terminal there, on Flora Bank, in that area, you have tankers going and everything, you will destroy that critical area for salmon.
While black students at the University of Missouri in the U.S. continue to rally against anti-black racism on their campus, many universities have come out in support. At the University of Toronto, a loose coalition of black students and their supporters rallied on campus on November 18th in support of Missouri, but also to highlight the systemic anti-black racism on the U of T campus.
A couple hundred black students and their supporters gathered for a march and rally through the University of Toronto campus to show their solidarity with University of Missouri black students who have been staging protests and rallies since September, demanding that university administration address the daily anti-black racism on campus, which included death threats by white supremacist groups. The Black at U of T protest on Wednesday also highlighted the systemic anti-black racism at the University of Toronto and was a forum for black undergrads, grad students, faculty, and staff at the university to share their experiences of being black on campus.
Why am I being asked for the black perspective?
Om Salma Rahamtula brings us
the
support from Toronto.
Why am I not showing these racist videos in our classes? Why can't I say anything? Why are my opinions being taken as me being angry and combative and loud? The angry black woman.
I've been part of the Students' Union for about 3 years now, and every single time I go to a meeting in the administration, I'm the lone black folk in the room. Like, imagine going to a space with all, as you sure said, like, all old white men looking at you, and whenever the issues come about students, about black people on campus, everyone just turns their head to you and like, okay, what do you have to share?
The fact that these movements are present because of the hard work of black students, but more particularly black women who have took charge in these movements, and I want to say thank you. Because you have provided me with the space to share my struggles, share my concerns, but more importantly, be safe.
Yusra is part of a collective of Black students who organized the rally and highlighted some of the demands that they want the University of Toronto administration to address.
Well, it's a long list, about like 9 demands. What we want the administration to address is the underrepresentation of faculty, students, people who are in health and wellness or so, student services. There's a lack of Black representation there, and we want to address why. Why is that an issue and why is that happening? We also want to talk about the Eurocentric curriculums in our school and how there is no consideration of other narratives other than like white narratives. We want to talk about divesting from funding private prison corporations. We want to talk about culturally appropriate services for mental health for Black students. We're also asking for the Black and or African Thought Department to be created because there isn't one. We're also asking for funding transitional year program to increase because at this point they're cutting funding.
This is Ome Salma Rahimtula reporting for Groundwire from Toronto on the traditional territories of the Mississaugas of the New Credit.
The BC Supreme Court dismissed a judicial review of a controversial alpine ski resort launched by the West Kootenay Eco Society. Catherine Fisher brings us this headline from CJLY in Nelson, BC.
On November 10th, a BC Supreme Court justice ruled that the province of British Columbia did not err in creating a municipality with no residents to facilitate the Jumbo Glacier Resort development. The Jumbo Resort is a large ski and recreation resort city proposed to be built on ecologically sensitive glacial land in the Purcell Mountains. The West Kootenay Eco Society, which is based in Nelson, launched the court challenge in 2013, arguing that the resort municipality with no residents violates provincial laws requiring municipalities to serve community interests. Senex Nation opposed the project because it will adversely affect ecological values in the area they call Piksmikun, white grizzly bear in the Senex language. The Jumbo Pass is an area of core sustenance for grizzly bears in the region and also home to ecologically significant wolverine, mountain goat, and West Slope cutthroat trout populations. Jumbo is also an important transit area for the endangered mountain caribou. The nearby Tanaha Nation also opposes the proposed resort city, as do many others. People opposed say the planned luxury resort is financially unviable, will have adverse and irreparable effects on the ecosystem, and they worry because BC taxpayers will have to pay the maintenance of the necessary roads and amenities in support of this privately owned project. Many also believe that the BC government's process in approving the project has been undemocratic and improper. In 2009, the resort's developer Glacier Resorts Limited applied to the Regional District of the East Kootenay to have their site zoned for development. The RDEK sent it on to the provincial government. The government, encouraged by Minister Bill Bennett, responded by passing Omnibus Bill 41, which created a mountain resort municipality and appointed a mayor and council to make land use decisions for the Jumbo project. At that time of approval, the provincial government said in a press release they believed this resort municipality is the governance structure best suited to administering development of the resort. Project opponents call it a fake municipality, citing the fact that it has no residents, no infrastructure, and no tax base, and that its provincially appointed officials are accountable only to the Jumbo Resort Master Plan, therefore only to the minister and the project developer Glacier Resorts Limited. Here's what Eco Society Executive Director David Reed had to say about the judgment.
Unfortunately, I feel, you know, the question isn't truly totally answered because the judge chose to use a fairly narrow reading of the Local Government Act. So we'll continue to explore our options. But the bottom line for Eco Society is that the fight continues. And, you know, we've been fighting the Jumbo fight for 25 years. We're certainly not going to stop now. I think there's a lot of reason to believe that citizens can prevail in protecting our environment and, you know, getting what's best for our communities in the long term. And we just have to keep up that fight.
That's it for headlines. Now it's time for our feature stories. Manitoba's chief energy utility, Manitoba Hydro, is in the midst of a massive expansion of its electrical generating and transmission capacity across the province. One of the ongoing projects, the Kiask Generating Station, holds the promise of supplying 4,400 gigawatt hours of electricity each year to a growing Manitoban population. However, a number of concerns have been brought forward about the treatment of the workers at the remote northern site where this facility is being built, which is challenging Manitoba Hydro's stated claims of providing a safe and harassment-free workplace environment. CKUW's Michael Welch investigated the situation and brings us this report.
BBE Hydro Construction LP was contracted by Manitoba's chief energy utility, Manitoba Hydro, to oversee the construction of the Kiask Electrical Generating Station, which is situated at a remote location 725 kilometers northeast of Winnipeg. BBE is now in the crosshairs for practices that compromise the health and safety of its workers. Mike Hawkins is a member of Fox Lake Cree Nation, which is one of the four First Nations involved in the Kiask project. During a live radio broadcast for CKUW in early November, he exposed some of what he experienced in his time at the remote site.
I just don't like their work ethics up there on how they hire Aboriginals and Métis people. And then if they start speaking out about what's going on there with the problems and all this, then they get let go. Like as for me, I got let go because I kept bringing up problems up there. When I had my chest problems, I had to drive all the way from where I was situated all the way to where the safety guy was. I nearly went off the road a couple of times there when I was driving back by myself there. And I think I stayed in a medics thing there for about 2 hours, close to 2 hours before they finally decided to take me to town.
The issue of adequate medical attention for workers who fall ill or are injured on site were of particular significance to the family of Joe Head. A safety rep found him in great distress, suffering from severe headaches. Emergency services personnel, located 20 kilometers away, arrived and determined he needed to be moved to a hospital. By the time he arrived at the nearest hospital in Gillam, 2 hours had elapsed, and he died on arrival. Head's widow, Val, is convinced that her husband's death was preventable. Medics could have gotten to him quicker if they weren't located so far away from the main camp, and a helicopter could have been used to transport him to the nearest hospital.
There is a heliport there. Mm-hmm. There is choppers. There's three of them. But that didn't happen. They didn't keep their promise that, you know, that a man would be medevaced out in that situation.
Do you have any idea why that didn't happen?
They said it's the provincial government does not allow for a man to be taken into a chopper. So I said, like, if somebody severs an artery or, you know, cuts their leg off or anything, you're just going to look at the poor guy and say, I'm sorry, but you know what? We can't do nothing for you.
Scott Powell is manager of public affairs for Manitoba Hydro. I asked him to respond to the concerns raised by the workers and their families.
It's important to note that at Kiask, we have advanced primary care paramedics on site, as well as standard paramedics, and it's one of the few locations outside of Winnipeg and Brandon where an advanced primary care paramedic is available. So the care he received is absolutely top-notch.
Do you not have some way of stepping up that time where you get them to a facility where they can get the treatment they need?
Well, they can get the treatment they need in the ambulance. It has advanced life support in it. It has an advanced primary care paramedic. I mean, you're getting the same level of care in that ambulance that you would get in an ambulance in Winnipeg.
Joe Head's daughter-in-law, Christy Knox, was not satisfied with this response.
You mean to tell me they got a fridge of blood in there? So if you're bleeding out, it's not like they can, you know, transfuse you with blood to keep you alive until you get to a hospital. There's just certain things that ambulances just can't do. Another example, clot busters are given to patients having strokes. It's to my understanding that it is only administered through hospitals.
When confronted with the accusation that Hydro's contracting partner may be violating its code of ethics, Scott Powell had this to say.
Provincial legislation has a number of safeguards to ensure that employees are not treated unfairly. As far as we're concerned, our contractors operating well within and exceeds provincial guidelines. If they have some concerns and they can't resolve it, then there's other avenues available to them to pursue, and they're free to do that.
If there are things being said or being done at that site that Hydro isn't aware of, and they're hearing it from us, from other employees that have been mistreated and let go unfairly, why aren't they looking into it? Why don't you actually turn around and say, you know what? We do care. We will look into that. That is not right.
Currently, the Head family is pushing for a public inquiry into Joe Head's death, and the local Industrial Workers of the World, of which this reporter is a member, has launched a campaign to raise awareness about alleged worker abuses at Kiask and push Manitoba Hydro to stop payments to its contract partner, BBE, until it ends its alleged abuse of worker rights. Reporting from Treaty 1 in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe, a king and homeland of the Métis, this is CKUW's Michael Welch for Groundwire.
Next, Mick Sweetman from CJRU The Scope at Ryerson talks with fashion, beauty, lifestyle writer September Anderson, a self-described reluctant activist about an incident in Toronto where a black middle school student was recently called into the principal's office over her natural hairstyle.
I'm with September Anderson, a freelance fashion, beauty, and lifestyle writer and a reluctant activist.
Good day.
Good day. Thank you for joining us. Just over a week ago, a grade 8 student at a middle school in North Toronto was allegedly called into the principal's office about her natural hairstyle. Can you tell me what you know about this story?
A middle school student, as you said, was called into the office and told that her hair was too poofy and unprofessional and that she wouldn't get a job. This story began circulating all over Facebook. Somebody sent me a look and they're like, take a look at that. And so I was furiously trying to promote the story to get some kind of action on that and raise awareness about what's going on in Toronto.
In the summertime, you actually wrote an article for Vice Canada on dress codes in school.
Yes, I did. I was looking at the ways in which dress codes are Eurocentric, transphobic, racist, and all of those other things, generally oppressive, and the unique ways in which it affects different groups of students at different intersections. So I did look at how black female students who have a higher rate of being policed or being suspended for dress code violations, despite wearing the same types of clothing, and of course how hair gets policed in those situations, as well as headwear.
How are black women, girls' hair specifically police more? Like, why is it more under more scrutiny?
I think because they exist at an intersection of oppression. Not only are they black, but they're also women. And so being at a double, you know, and having that double jeopardy and experiencing that heightened scrutiny, I think that's why. And it's sad to happen because so often we see that young girls and young black girls are not allowed to be girls. They're not allowed to be children. They're hypersexualized. And it's very so problematic and so hurtful. Even going back to the story of the little girl in middle school, apparently her aunt had did her hair. And I keep on thinking about how she felt when she went to school and she must have thought she had this amazing hairdo. She was going to go and everybody was going to compliment her. She felt so good. And then to be dragged into the principal's office and told that her hair is poofy and unprofessional and that she'd never get a job. And especially more hurtful because it was coming from another black woman, that she was being policed by somebody who she may have thought was an ally or a friend or a sympathizer.
You not only are you a writer, but you're a mother as well. Is your child in the public education system?
Yes, he is. He has very curly hair that he wears out as well. And he's come home and asked me a lot of times if he can have a haircut or that he wishes that he has golden hair. And so it's also upsetting that he doesn't get to see a lot of people who look like him, because a lot of us, when we move into the professional world, we do contain our hair or straighten it or wear weaves or all of these other things so that we don't stand out and so that who we are as people, our capabilities and abilities are the things that stand out and not the things that people perceive as different or quote unquote unprofessional.
Getting back to the story about the middle school girl, like, what was your reaction when you first heard about it?
I was so angry and sad. And it was also in the story where the aunt said that the little girl tried to stand up for herself and be like, no, and I imagine this little girl, 12, 13, 14, in the principal's office with an adult who has all of this power and trying to advocate for herself and being made put into tears. I remember my mother did my hair for picture day and I didn't like it. And I honestly felt that my life was over, that that was the end of my life as I knew it. My hair looked terrible. My life is over. You know what I mean? And with all those hormonal changes and all of those things, I can only imagine what that little girl felt like, that she was on this emotional roller coaster where she felt so good and then she felt so bad. I just feel terrible for her. Even from a child psychology standpoint, I'm sure it was a very traumatizing experience. And I am glad that the news stories that are coming out don't mention the girl's name, because I can only imagine how mortified she is.
Thank you very much for your time, September. I very much appreciate you coming in to talk with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you.
The last episode of Groundwire featured an interview that had to be removed. An apology was issued by the contributing station, and Groundwire echoes the sentiments expressed in this apology.
On November 5th, we aired an interview regarding Turner Island. We received a letter from the legal counsel for the Council of the Tlawitsis Tribe and First Nation. They expressed concerns with what was said, and they felt that some of the information that was presented was inaccurate. We apologize if any of what was said was inaccurate or lowered the reputation of any individuals. As requested, we have removed the broadcast from Co-op Radio's online archives. We have extended an invitation for a spokesperson of the Tlawitsis tribe and First Nation to make a statement for air or to be interviewed on this topic. We have not yet received a response.
An information notice regarding the land purchase issued by the Tlawitsis First Nation was read by Gennarji O'Sullivan.
The Tlawitsis Nation is hearing a lot of interest from non-Tlawitsis members on their offer to purchase land south of Campbell River from Timber West for the development of a new reserve community for the Tlawitsis members. The Tlawitsis Nation wishes to provide these persons with the facts regarding this land deal. This is a land purchase agreement. The Tlawitsis Nation has signed an offer to purchase agreement to buy these lands with the intention of creating a new community for our membership. There is no land swap of sale of the Tlawitsis Nation's traditional territory in this deal. The Tlawitsis Nation is in the treaty negotiation process to secure our traditional territory lands for our membership. Selling lands in this traditional territory would go against our position at the treaty table and the wishes of the membership. The reserves in the Tlawitsis Nation territory are held under Section 18 of the Indian Act, which are under the control of Aboriginal and Northern Affairs Canada. The Tlawitsis Nation cannot sell reserve land. The membership of the Tlawitsis Nation has met at regional meetings throughout the treaty process and has discussed this deal with them. Membership has participated in a formal survey, and the Tlawitsis Nation has obtained overwhelming support for the purchase and development of a new community on these lands for our members. These lands are large enough to support the future growth of our membership and our children's future. These lands will more than double the amount of existing reserve lands for the Tlawitsis Nation. As I said, these lands are large enough to support the future growth of our membership and our children's future. The Tlawitsis Nation has letters of support from all the First Nations that claim the territory where these lands are situated. We are also have letters of support from other First Nations within 70 kilometer radius from these lands. The Deputy Minister of Indian Affairs, along with representatives from the BC Regional Office, are very supportive of this land deal. They have assisted us in the preparation of the package to be sent to Ottawa under the addition to reserve process. If people believe that our children and our future and are our future, then it is our responsibility to provide them with the best opportunity to move forward. It is very important for the well-being of our members to provide them with a place to call home where they can share our culture, history, and provide a community to call home for our future generations.
That's it for this edition of Groundwire, produced at CFRC in Kingston on traditional Haudenosaunee and Anishinaabe territory. Music this week was by the classic Tennessee Ernie Ford, and the headlines were written by Oma Salma Rahamtula, Catherine Fisher, and Sheila Ferrando. We'd also like to thank Prison Radio CKUT, Michael Welch, Mick Sweetman, Gennarji O'Sullivan, Carly Forbes, myself, Nathan Bateman, and you can't forget Matt Willish. Tune in again to hear Groundwire on your local community radio station, on the Rabble Podcast Network, or you can always download at groundwire.ncra.ca. Groundwire is a project of the members of the National Campus and Community Radio Association.